Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Good morning to you all, ladies and gentlemen. This is Richard Martin from the Wake Up Call in Singapore on the 20th of July. That's Friday, the 20th of July, 2012. And I'm going to try to wrap it up a little bit today, putting it all together, all within the main framework of the subject matter that I promised that I would concentrate on in this year 2012, namely debt. Why? I mean, basically, we are in a debt super cycle. This is the age of debt. Debt is something without which it would have been very hard to compete in our world. Well, no prizes for guessing when it all started. It actually started right on the dot, the 15th of August, 1971, with the fateful decision by Nixon to cancel the dollar off the gold standard. And almost from that day, debt started to become accumulated seriously by the Federal Reserve, courtesy of the Federal Reserve. What this amounted to, and has amounted to since then, is massive borrowing, both private and public, to the extent that now we stand today at $53 trillion of debt. Now, I don't expect you to have any idea of what that means. In fact, I'd be surprised if you're still awake listening to the wake-up call, frankly, after having listened to that kind of a figure which means nothing. But I assure you, ladies and gentlemen, this is cataclysmic. This is irreparable. It's irretrievable. It's way past the point of no return. And each person writes his own script describing how he thinks the whole thing will end, because it's not in the history books, it's not in the textbooks of economics. There is nobody who has the slightest idea how this horror is going to end, but it is going to be absolutely cataclysmic. There is no question that it can be any other way. But of course, the people responsible are called Keynesians. In other words, they believe in printing money. They believe in money is the solution to everybody's problem, and all you have to do is to print a little bit more. And so they just say it's irrelevant. They say, well, no problem, we'll just inflate. And if we inflate, then $53 trillion won't be $53 trillion in today's terms anymore, will it? And then we'll be able to just print the money and pay the debt, and everybody will be fine. Well, of course, you know, it can't happen. And the reason it can't happen, when people say, oh, well, we can't just super-inflate ourselves out of trouble, but the real reason why that is because when you have that kind of inflation or that kind of debt, the economy simply can't grow. It can't grow because so much money is used paying off the debt which has been incurred in terms of interest payments, monthly or six-monthly or yearly interest payments, month after month, year after year. It just hobbles the economy. It means that there's no money to put into new development. And therefore, you have stagnation, more and more unemployment as businesses can't make it because consumers can't consume. And the economy simply cannot grow. Quite apart from anything else, you look around today, first of all, the federal government is completely bankrupt. You know, it's $16 trillion in debt and a trillion more every single year, certainly next year. And then, of course, comes the torrent of lies that go along with all this. For example, GDP is up 50% from the lows. Why is it up 50%? Because of the drawdown in savings. Remember, when you spend money, it goes into GDP. Nobody cares where the money comes from. It just goes into GDP. The first quarter was a 2.2% increase, mainly consumption expenditure. That's what people do. They consume, they spend, and it obediently goes straight into GDP. The fact that they use their credit cards, that they're further in hock, doesn't worry GDP in the slightest. And that's not production. The only real way in which an economy grows is through healthy production, because people produce, other people consume, and life goes on. And again, you know, profits are way overstated. The profits, again, are based on debt. They don't care where the money comes from to create the things that then get sold at a profit. If it comes from debt, so be it, still called profits. But of course, they're way overstated, and that's what they don't tell you in the headlines of the newspapers that you pick up every day, or the cute blondes that come on talking about this kind of thing on the money shows and on the regular mainstream news shows. Oh, they don't tell you how those profits got created. You see, everything that looks good is a consequence of the creation of debt. Never forget that. Even when you see house prices going up or more houses being sold, they're not being sold with cash. They're being sold with yet more debt. They're not finished with this debt nonsense. They've got a lot of debt yet to play out before they in the United States, call it a day. Of course, in Europe, they can't go anywhere because Spain and Greece, nobody wants to lend them any money. So they're now heaving for breath. But for the rest of us, we're still in this frightful debt cycle of 30 years duration and counting. You know, in Greece and Spain, they've got a gun to their heads. They can't produce any more debt. They're into austerity right now. They have to cut back. And look at the trouble it's causing. Look at the tremendous social unrest that's happening in those countries. Look, here's the deal. Wealth is created by producing things and selling them at a profit. That's how you create wealth. You don't create wealth by trading pieces of paper backwards and forwards, stocks, bonds, unit trusts, contracts in commodities, derivatives. That's not the creation of wealth. That's just playing with money. People can get rich off it, but that's not creating wealth, and you can't survive like that for very long. You know, the only way that the capital markets work is to punish the speculators who speculate wrong, just as they used to do before the creation of the Fed in 1914. Before 1914, if you were a big honcho in business and you made a mistake, they took you to the cleaners. I mean, there were in the early 1900s, copper magnates went out of business, railroad tycoons went out of business. Between 8 and 10, I don't know the exact figure, 8 and 10 railroads went bankrupt in 2 months in the first decade of the 1900s. You know, the system went bankrupt. The banking interests went out of business in 1907. There was a tremendous banking crisis. But the deal was that the system went on and recovered quickly. You know, there was no national interest rate. There was no Ben Bernanke pontificating about where the interest rate should be. It wasn't the Fed's job. Of course, the Fed didn't even exist in those days, which was a mercy. But even when it came in to begin with, it didn't even consider that it should govern where interest rates were. The market took care of that. Well, of course, now we have the monetary central planners, you know, buying debt that no one else will. And that's only existed since 20 years. It's plain Ponzi economics, ladies and gentlemen. It is truly what Bernie Madoff did, magnified thousands of times over. Households are trapped, you know, originally lured in by bad monetary policy. You know, those mortgage brokers that were going around that you heard so much from, they were all made possible, spawned by the Federal Reserve's easy money policy. Do you know that today 25 million households cannot move? They are locked. They're trapped in their homes, all because of mortgages that were made possible courtesy of your charming Fed chairman, Alan Greenspan. So now these people are paralyzed. 25 million households. You know, and the Fed is entirely responsible for this. You know, Greenspan panicked in December 2000. The interest rates at that time were 6.5%. But when he looked around, he could see that the economy was being threatened by competitors all over the world. So he cheated. He tried to snooker the system. In between 1 and 2 years, they took the interest rates down to 1%, from 6.5% to 1%. And that's what caused the great housing boom. And they thought they could cock a snoop at the rest of the world. You can't do that to us. We're America. We're the United States. We're the people that can call the shots here. So down he put the rates, and it did nothing. It merely caused a financial upheaval, a volcano, an eruption of housing prices at low rates of mortgages, where people were sucked in to what they couldn't afford. And there's this man who goes around today making money off his book tours. And this is a criminal. And the man should be in jail, locked up, and they've thrown away the key. You know? But that's the way it was, you know? The Fed balance sheet was $30 billion in 1960. And that took 40 years to build to that $30 billion. And by September 2008, the balance sheet had gone from 30 to $900 billion. And then following the collapse and the crisis in 2008, when Hank Paulson panicked along with Bernanke, the Fed increased its balance sheet by $900 billion. It doubled it in 7 weeks. And then that was as much as in the first 93 years of the Fed, in 7 weeks, doubled. But that wasn't it. Another 6 weeks later, just 6 weeks, another $900 billion. In other words, in 13 weeks, the Fed had tripled its balance sheet. And the Fed, of course, is the representative of the people. So that's your money, ladies and gentlemen, your money that has been thrown into the system, conjured up out of thin air, thrown into the system. And now, of course, the Fed is trapped. Because, you see, it can't reduce its balance sheet, which it has to do at some point. It's got to claw all that money back at some point. But it can't do that because it fears panic. And panic it will get. And people are beginning to realize that the Fed is trapped. Why do you think the Fed can't put out QE3? It can't put out QE3 because it's dead scared. Bernanke is a scared man. You could see it in his face this week in his report to Congress. He is a very frightened man. He doesn't know what to do. And the reason he doesn't know what to do is because there is nothing for him to do. He can do nothing. He is trapped, just like those homeowners. He is trapped. He can't do anything. So I say to you, don't buy anything. When the panic comes, every asset will collapse, every single one. Gold, copper, silver, soybeans, everything. Stocks, bonds, houses, the whole thing will collapse. Because you see, everything is priced off the treasury market. Real estate, loans, bank securities, corporate bonds, mortgage-backed securities, junk bonds, all of them are priced off the treasury. So you watch those bonds. When those bonds start to collapse, you will know that there is trouble ahead. It may not happen immediately. And there may well be panic even if the bond price doesn't go down. But I can tell you at some point, the lack of confidence will become obvious. And hopefully it's people like me that are able to bring some light to these proceedings. Because you won't find it in the mainstream, I can assure you of that. You know, the government spending will stop. It will just come to a stop. There will be no money. Look what's happening. All these cities in California going broke. They're bankrupt. They can't afford to pay the money. They can't afford to... They've been raped by the system already. Their tax takings have collapsed. And now they're bankrupt. And along with all this, as it happens, consumption will collapse, which means corporations will suffer enormously. And that's about to happen. People are consuming less and less as it is. What they are consuming, we can see from the figures, is still being paid for out of credit cards. As I say, let me repeat this. Borrowing adds to GDP, but it does not add to wealth. And we've been looking at artificial growth based on borrowing for 30 years. And now, ladies and gentlemen, it is payback time. The contraction is going to happen in front of your eyes. You see, this GDP, this gross domestic product statistic, which is the most dishonest, extraordinarily stupid statistic I've ever seen, it was designed by Keynesians who don't believe in a balance sheet. Their opinion is that if people are borrowing, just add it into the GDP statistics. It'll look good. But sooner or later, the balance sheet just collapses. And when it does, God help those people who still have assets. And I hope that isn't anyone among you, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you have sold everything that is of any value whatsoever to you. Because if you haven't, at least you'll never be able to say you weren't warned, or nobody told you, or you didn't know, or how could you have known? Unfortunately, I'm here with the same message, week in, week out. I mean, look at Bernanke. The only thing he could do is to print money by buying bonds to juice the markets and give the money, of course, to the banks. It's done nothing for the economy, all this money. You know, if it was going to do anything, why wouldn't the economy already be responding? It should be. It's had two QE2s and a twist, or whatever they call it. And the answer is because it doesn't work. You can't draw blood from a stone. If you put money into the economy, you depend on commercial banks who have their own profit bottom lines to consider to lend that money out. And if the bank's clients are no good for the loans, they don't lend the money. It's as simple as that, and Bernanke knows it, and that's why he's a worried man. But of course, the financial media are gung-ho. They love this. The markets go up, you know, they've got a drought now, so up go all the agricultural commodities, and they say everything is fine because prices are rising. This will never be successful, ladies and gentlemen. It will all end in disaster. Look at the figures. The economy continues to weaken. Retail sales were down 0.5% in June. That is the third month in a row of negative sales. And now here's a statistic for you. Did you know that retail sales being down 3 months in a row has only happened 27 times since retail sales were first reported in 1947? And in 25 of those 27 times, the economy was in a recession or within 3 months of one. Deflation is gaining the upper hand. Prices are coming down. Do not listen to anybody who talks about inflation. It's over. Enough with that nonsense. I've been saying this over and over and over again, and I'm still getting questions. Do you think we're going to see inflation in this or in that? Or what about the inflation here? No, I don't think. There is none. Look at the housing market, which everybody says, oh, the housing market's doing so well. It's coming up now. It's been going up. The sales of houses is not increasing. The housing starts maybe up 6%, but that's not sales. And in the meantime, you know, these balance sheets of the Fed and the ECB, the European Central Bank, are nothing short of bloated. They're utterly vulnerable. If those interest rates go up, I mean, I'll talk about that on another show, the consequence of a rise in interest rates, but it's horrific, the things that will happen when interest rates move up. And the Fed, of course, has accomplished nothing. Thank you very much. All right. Well, let me give you my information, and then we'll move on. The toll-free number is 888-874-4888. Do feel constrained to call in if you would like to. We would love to hear from you, as always. Again, it's 888-874-4888. And if you'd like to write into my email, it is email address is rm for Richard Martin at gfawd.com. rm at gfawd for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design, gfawd.com. And if you'd like to call me in private, it's 941-441-1682. I will lend a sympathetic ear, and I will try to help sort out whatever entanglements you may have with the system, financially speaking, and any other speaking that I can lay my hands on. I will do my best. My number here in Sarasota, Florida, which comes straight through to Singapore, is 941-441-1682. Again, 941, that's the area code, 441-1682, and as always, call any time, leave a name and a phone number, and I will call you back. Now we have come to the moment of truth, ladies and gentlemen. This weekend, the Richard Martin Meetup Group in New Brunswick. Now we are going to have a speaker called Brian, who will be talking about a job that you can do when you arrive in your chosen land of milk and honey, and that will be teaching English as a foreign language. It's a doozy, it's a shoo-in. If you can point at a table and know how to say table in English, point at a chair and say chair, and then say this is a table, this is a chair, you're halfway there. That's all you have to do. It's really very simple. And you can take courses which are fairly inexpensive. It's quite exciting. You can make some money for yourself. And if you do happen to land a couple of business clients who need to learn English quickly to go and do a deal in Australia or Canada or something, the money is not bad, I can tell you. It's not a bad. You might decide to stay with it. Brian certainly did, and he's been in Korea for 14 years. So it's a fascinating possibility. Don't miss the opportunity. It's free, ladies and gentlemen. You don't have to pay to go to this. The restaurant likes you to have some, you know, sandwich or something to drink, you know, but basically it's entirely free. You will listen to Brian. He will tell you how to do this. He'll walk you through the process. And it is not complicated. And so that's how you can do it. That's how you can get out of the States without a job and land one pretty quickly once you arrive. Now, the meeting is, as always, in the same place in the George Street Ale House. It's in New Brunswick, New Jersey. It's on Sunday, the 22nd. That's the day after tomorrow, 2 p.m. There is a train that takes you to New Brunswick. And it goes from all over the East Coast, I believe. It stops in New Brunswick, and it's halfway between New York City and Philadelphia. And so you can come from Washington or wherever you come from by train. It's very quick. And there's also good parking in George Street. It's at 371 George Street in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And again, it's 2 o'clock on the 22nd. Now, Jack has actually asked me to give out a couple of websites for you in anticipation of the meeting, which, of course, is useful to anybody, whether or not you have gone to the meeting. You can still benefit from learning about the teaching of English as a foreign language. He's asked me to provide you with a few links, so get your pencils and paper ready, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to read off a couple of websites here which you might want to get down in preparation for the Sunday meeting. Please do, by the way, call Jack before you go. He needs to just sort out the room in the restaurant. So please call Jack Chavesta. His number is 914-414-6940. You can call him even on Sunday morning, but do please call him as soon as you know that you can make it, so that he's getting, you know, some feedback about how many people to expect. Again, his name is Jack, and his phone number is 914 414-6940. Okay, here are the websites that he wants me to give to you. The first one is www.eslcafe.com. The ESL, England, Susan, London, ESL, ESLcafe, all one word, .com. The next one is http://teflonline.net, teflonline.net. The next one is HTTP with a colon, that's www.cambridgeesol.org. That's Cambridge and then E-S-O-L. So there's two E's there, one for Cambridge and one for E-S-O-L. cambridgeesol.org/exams/celta-online/index.html. So I'm going to read that once more. So see if you can get, I'll read it real slow, so make sure you can get it down. The Cambridge, the word Cambridge is followed by the letters E-S-O-L. So you're going to have Cambridge and then another E. S-O-L. Okay, so again, it's www.cambridgeesol.org, that's O-R-G, /exams/celta-online/index.html. Right, now if you didn't get that, please send me an email or call me or something, and I'll give you that all over again. But hopefully you got it. Also, I had an email from a listener who attended last month's meetup group and would like to correspond with the person who also attended from Rochester, New York. Now, if that person from the last meetup group who came all the way from Rochester is listening, would you please send me an email and I will hook you up with somebody who would like to talk to you. I'm doing my best, and I won't give your name away, but that's pretty much all I can do. I hope that person will, in fact, write to me, and then I will hook you up. All right. Well, we are a few moments away, before we do that, then please... let's hear from Brian. He's on hold right now. And so, Brian, welcome to the show. I hope you have approved
of
what I've said.
Hi, Richard. Thanks for taking my call. Let's see. Thank you so much for mentioning those websites. I know that ESL Cafe website is really, really good. Lots of information on different parts of the world you can click on, Asia or South America or... Middle East, and you find lots of resources on those regions. And lots of posts by teachers in those countries, ESL teachers in those countries, and people ask questions and people answer questions. So it's like frequently asked questions type thing on any country. The other thing is, are you there, by the way? Hello?
Yeah, we're here.
Okay, sorry. I just want to say, teaching ESL, that's English as a Second Language, or EFL, English as a Foreign Language, is what I teach, because I teach overseas. It's a lot of fun. I've had a lot of fun teaching over 10 years in Korea, but I've also visited other countries, and I know people teaching in China, Thailand, and so forth, Indonesia, and let's see. So anyways, I want to on Sunday, I want to talk about getting credentials. You know, for instance, getting a TEFL certificate or a CELTA certificate to help you get a job, and how to find a job. A lot of these jobs can be found online, depending on the country. And you don't necessarily have to be a native speaker of English. If you have an American or Canadian passport, that suffices.
Very good.
In some countries you need a bachelor's degree, some countries you do not. Sometimes an AS degree, associate's degree will suffice. I also, on Sunday, I'll also talk about some of the nightmare stories, like, for instance, these great jobs that advertise that turn out to be slave jobs, and so forth.
Well, listen, Brian, I know you have to go. I got your email saying you had to leave at 10:30, so thank you very much indeed for giving us a heads up. And again, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to go, Brian will be there on Sunday, 2 p.m. in New Brunswick. And please, please give Jack a call. Let him know. He'll give you all the information that I haven't given you. Again, his number is 914-414-6940. And Brian, good luck. I hope you have a good meeting, and look forward to hearing, you know, feedback afterwards. And take care. And
okay.
How long are you staying before you go back to Korea? When do you leave?
Mid-August,
Korea again?
I go back.
Sounds good. All right, Brian. Well, take care. I hope to hear from you soon. And ladies and gentlemen, time has come for us to go for our break, and I'll be right back. Okay, well, listen, I would like to bring you now a couple of interviews, basically from other people who are also convinced that we are already in the Depression. And the first one comes from Al Lewis on the News Hub, who says that we're actually in a depression right now. It's just that most people don't see it. And his sort of flagship statistic is that 1 out of 7 Americans is, you know, on food stamps. And his point, of course, is that if they weren't getting cards in the mail every month, you'd be seeing them in the soup lines. And so don't be fooled by the fact that you don't see the manifestations of a depression in the same way that you did in the 1930s, because technology has just put it behind closed doors. Anyway, why don't we listen to it? Without further ado, let's go to Al Lewis on the News Hub talking about the Great Depression.
We're going to be joined now by the author of The New Depression, The Breakdown of the Paper Money Economy, Richard Duncan. Richard, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Now, we'll all be listening up to this one because obviously we've been in several cadences and several mutations of this crisis. Now, what do you think was the prime cause for getting us into this paper money drama, so to speak?
Right. I think in order to understand this crisis, it's necessary to understand the role that credit has played in bringing it about. So when we broke the link between money and gold 40 years ago, this removed all the constraints on credit creation. And afterwards, credit absolutely exploded. In the U.S., it grew from $1 trillion to $50 trillion, 50-fold increase in 43 years. And this explosion of credit created the world we live in. It created very rapid economic growth. It ushered in the age of globalization. But it now seems that credit cannot expand any further because the private sector is incapable of repaying the debt that it has already. And if credit now begins to contract, there is a very real danger that we will collapse into a new Great Depression.
Now, when one reads one's old Karl Marx, he said something, not in connection with gold, but he said something very similar. When the capital markets remove themselves too much from the real economy, you get into turmoil and a breakdown of the money system. Do we have to move, in fact, a way? Do we have to break, or do we have to get back to a link between the real economy or and or gold and paper money?
Well, there's no easy way to go back to that link. And I think the Austrian economist, Ludwig von Mises, and they were very good in understanding the role that credit played in creating the crisis. As long as credit grows rapidly, that makes the economy grow. And however, the day always comes when credit can't expand any further, and then the new depression begins.
Now, that brings us back to the old discussion we had here with Roger before, that politicians, unfortunately, are scared of recession, never mind depression, and they probably won't implement any kind of policies that gets us back to reason, because one of them would include letting a number of banks fail, etc. So, to put it mildly, what is your conclusion? Where do we go from here?
Right, I think the thing that's driving government policy now is the belief that if they allow credit to contract, that we will have a new Great Depression. Milton Friedman taught Ben Bernanke that the Fed could have prevented the Great Depression if the Fed had prevented the money supply from contracting. But now credit is the new money. And if they don't prevent the credit supply from contracting, then we will have a new depression. So the policy is to ensure that credit continues to expand. And now that's what government debt is doing. The increase in government debt is making total debt grow. Otherwise, we would have already collapsed into a debt deflation death spiral.
Richard, first up, if I can take an issue with you about the name of the title. I was reading a book in a coffee store on the weekend, and I swear everyone around me thought I was reading about mental health. The new depression is certainly the big title out there, but it is indeed a situation that almost policymakers are dealing with. How do you solve this? And it's almost like mental health in a way. This sounds like, if you think there should be further credit expansion, that QE 3, 4, 5, 6, and forevermore is going to be happening in the U.S. economy as far out as we can see.
You know, we're in a very unfortunate position to be here on the teetering on the verge of a new Great Depression. But this explosion of credit has created a kind of new economic system. I call it creditism. Now, creditism creates great perils. If it begins to contract, we will collapse. But it also creates tremendous opportunities. And the opportunities we're overlooking. The opportunity is our governments have the ability to borrow massive amounts of money at just 1.5% interest. If they borrow aggressively and invest this in transformative 21st century technologies, they could actually generate enormous investment returns and new technologies that would end this crisis and, in fact, bring about a technological revolution that would improve the well-being of everyone on this planet.
Okay. All right, ladies and gentlemen. Well, that was actually the second clip I wanted to play you. That was Richard Duncan, the author of The New Depression, his new book, talking to an interviewer on CNBC's Squawk Box from last Monday. I haven't read the book, but I have read a lot of good things about it, and it might be certainly an idea for you to keep a lookout for books such as this one. I will try to bring your attention to them as and when they come about. Again, it's called The New Great Depression, and the name of the author is Richard Duncan. Now I think we'll, without sort of further ado, we will go to the first of the clips that I had mentioned to you with Al Lewis talking and his take on the new depression, and you can compare the two people, and pretty much I think you're going to find the same approach, the same kind of attitude. But why don't we listen to Al Lewis for a few moments?
You may not know this, but we're in a depression. Maybe you can't see it. Well, that's because it's invisible. That's what Al Lewis, my friend and colleague, says, and he joins me on the set now.
Hi, Simon.
You're in from Colorado. Thank you very much for being here.
Well, thanks for having me.
So, the invisible, you can't see it, you can't touch it, but you can feel it.
Yeah, you know how Ben Bernanke said that he helped us avert a great recession? I think what he really did is he blinded us to the fact that there's a great recession. You know, we have 1 out of 7 Americans on food stamps.
One out of seven.
It's a shocking number. It gets used a lot, but it's still a shocking number. And, you know, if all these people were in a line, right, it would just look just like the Great Depression, right? We'd all be waiting in line for soup and bread. Instead, you get a little card in the mail, right? Mm-hmm. And there's really not even a stigma to using this card, as there used to be to food stamps.
Is that why so many people are using it, though? I mean, is part of it stigma and part of it...
There's no stigma anymore. I mean, if you're unemployed, this is the golden age, right? You get 99 weeks of unemployment. A lot of people have run through that already, right? So this invisible Great Depression may start to become more visible as we move from here. But that's just one element of it. You know, there's what we talk about is the shadow inventory of homes that might be foreclosed.
These are homes that the banks basically own but haven't yet really moved to foreclose and sell.
Right. Or they're people that haven't paid their mortgage, they've been living in their house for a year, and the banks haven't moved to foreclose on them. Mm. I mean, it goes on and on and on. But what happens when these hit the market? But this helps keep the Great Depression invisible. I think in commercial real estate, there's been a game going on for a long time called extend and pretend. You know, basically, these are on the books of some real estate investment trust, and they have a lot of leeway as to when they take the markdown on it. And, of course, they're taking it slowly. If all of this hit at once, we'd, of course, be in a lot of trouble. But they're able to keep this going, stretch it out, and what we're in, I call an invisible depression.
Can I add some other things to your list?
Sure.
Maybe you can get a crowdsource here, but one other thing we know about recent graduates, people of 2006, 2007, and beyond, is that they're not all of them are fully employed, not by a long way. And we're seeing a lot of people going back to school because they can't find the job they want. They think they'll get more credentials. Is that another part of this invisible depression?
I think so, because they are counted at as employed, right? Gainfully employed. You know, my wife goes to Nordstrom's, and most of the people that she deals with there have master's degrees.
Selling shoes. If you're going to get nice shoes, I guess that's the way to do it.
Right. But chronically underemployed people, as well as unemployed people.
Al, you're a smart guy. What's the answer? We need answers. Jerry gave his answer. You give yours.
Well, you know what? First of all, we need to recognize where we are. By pretending that things are okay, by lowering interest rates to zero and saying everything's going to be fine, don't worry, we'll have a QE3 if QE2 doesn't work out, we're ignoring the problem, right? The problem is that we need real growth in the economy that drives job growth. And, you know, one of the ways to get that is to worry about our trade deficit a little bit. I mean, we take all of the stimulus money, right, and we spend it. And where does it go? Consumers use that money to buy goods that are made in China. So it all just sort of leaks out. I mean, that would be one solution. But I say the first step in any recovery is to recognize you have a problem. And I don't think that we've fully done that.
So Ben Bernanke says, "Hi, I'm Ben Bernanke, and we're in the depression," is what he should say. And everyone should applaud him for saying that, is what you're saying.
You know what? I do admire him for at least not pretending that we're in a recovery. You know, when you see Mr. Bernanke, he's not the cheerleader that he was before this all began.
Okay, well, just a couple of clips. I'll bring them to you from time to time as the depression deepens. I think it's interesting to hear what other people have to say. Some people have asked me to interview people. I think it's more direct and to the point if I actually know in advance what they're going to say. So I know that what I bring you is likely to be of interest to you. From time to time, I will attempt to give you some live feed from some eminent people, if they will agree to be on the wake-up call. For the time being, however, let's go to a few emails. An email from Eric Lee, who says, "I understand the Federal Reserve is not a federal agency. Understand this and other revelations are new to me. And I've heard the federal income tax they leverage on the people pay back the interest on loans they give to the government. Is this illegal? Isn't paying federal income taxes unconstitutional? If you had any insight or could just expand on this subject, your sharing would be much appreciated. Please cite concrete resources I can turn to, if at all possible." From the point of view of the Constitution, and actually legally, you may not know this, but income tax is theoretically illegal. And I actually know one person in California who refuses to pay federal tax, and they haven't come after him. Interestingly enough, there are pockets of people who simply refuse to pay tax. And the IRS seems to take the view that it would be more irksome and bring more attention to this by going after these people than it would to collect the rather modest amount of tax that they probably owe, so they leave them alone. And you hit on a very, very good point here, as a matter of fact, Eric, because Of course, the Fed is not a federal agency. You understand that. And as I've always said to you, if you want proof, go to the yellow pages and you will find the Federal Reserve in the yellow section rather than the blue section, which is the government section. So, you know, there's plenty of evidence that the Fed is actually not connected legally with the government. But the point is, I'm not suggesting that anybody doesn't pay their taxes. I find that kind of somewhat, it's not the same thing as not paying your mortgage. I mean, in the end, you're going to get caught probably, and it probably won't pay to just to say that it's unconstitutional. The federal income tax isn't, no, I don't think it's true to say that it pays back interest on the loans that they give to the government. I don't think that that is really true. Income tax has its own horror stories, money being lost, you know, tens of billions of dollars lost in Iraq, which now in the final statement on the situation in Iraq is showing up, that this money has just disappeared. That's all your tax money, ladies and gentlemen, just frittered away, just gone, and nobody knows where. But thank you, Eric. Appreciate the email. Well, we haven't heard from Steve Kruger for a while, so why don't we give ourselves the joy and the pleasure of something from him. Richard, I can't help but wonder what's up with Angela Merkel. Over the past years, she has spoken like a staunch fiscal conservative, often referring to the mistakes of the 1920s, giving the impression that she would in no way put in jeopardy Germany's financial position in the EU or in world markets. In fact, up to a year ago, I would have bet money that she would be the first nation to leave the EU. Richard, when you're playing Monopoly with 27 other players and you have all the money and all the hotels, you have to ask yourself, just what do I have to gain by remaining in the game? I think Merkel has missed her opportunity to flee the EU. Now she sees buying the debt of nations sinking in debt as a good idea. Does Merkel think that the Titanic could have been saved if the captain had only pumped more water into it? It's time for her to fold up her game board and get Germany to higher ground. She needs to leave the EU, admit the massive error that the EU is, and get out. Richard, in my opinion, Merkel's actions defy common sense. If I'm wrong, tell me about it. Steve Kruger. Wish I could, Steve. You are 100% right. No questions at all. That is exactly the situation, and you have hit the nail quite firmly on the head. Stephen Wallachin from New York City wrote in saying, hello, Richard. On your program today, you mentioned how the U.S. government's monetary system based on debt is unsustainable. What countries are in good financial condition? And what kind of monetary system do they have? And you mentioned that the U.S. government could just print money themselves. But if they did, how could they do so with restraint so that they wouldn't print too much money? And if they print too much money, what would be the consequences? I look forward to your answers. Thank you. Stephen Wallachin, New York City. Well, Stephen, let's take the second question first. If the Treasury, by the government, you actually mean the Treasury, which is the department of the government which would be entrusted with these matters, if they printed money, it wouldn't be debt money. It would be money that would be needed specifically for the needs of the economy. That's what governments do when they're not making money for bankers and vested interests. And therefore, it would not be in their interest to print money which wasn't needed. And you see, the thing is, when a government prints money, usually there is a yardstick by which they judge the money, such as a gold standard, so that they actually hobble themselves by forcing themselves to restrain the amount of money they print by holding it to a standard which could be readily identified 24 hours a day. And that works. The problem is that when the banks get into the game, they're always claiming that they could do a better job than the government, and that they know how to handle money, and that sometimes it's even claimed that they create crises to force governments to push them into fractional reserve lending and other forms of money creation that I mentioned to you. Matt, if you're ready for the other clip, I wanted to just give you a quick explanation from Bill Still, who's a libertarian who's very interesting on financial matters, and I came across quite an interesting, very, very brief description of what is fractional reserve lending, and I've explained it so many times I thought it might be interesting for you to hear somebody else explain it. So let's go to Bill Still talking about fractional reserve lending.
Good afternoon from Los Angeles. I'm still reporting on the economy. So how do banks create all our money out of debt? It's called fractional reserve lending. Basically, banks got Congress to pass a law that allows them a monopoly on money. They get to lend every dollar into existence as a debt. When a U.S. bank buys a $100 U.S. bond, it gets to loan out 10 times that amount. So, the bank not only gets back the $100 plus interest from the federal government, it gets to loan out another $1,000 it doesn't have and charge additional interest. Banks are allowed to create this extra money out of thin air. So, banks aren't making only 6% interest, for example. They are really making over 1,000% interest. That's why bank buildings are the biggest in every town on the planet. This system of lending way more than you have is called fractional reserve lending. Almost all our money is created by banks, lending it to people, to companies, or to government. As we'll see, there is a better way for a government to get money. Simply issue it without debt for the benefit of all citizens equally. Abraham Lincoln did it, Ben Franklin did it, Jefferson wanted to do it. Honest Americans have fought against this bank-controlled debt money system throughout American history. But unless we change it soon, most of our freedoms will soon be lost in a tidal wave of debt. 75 years ago, an employee of the Atlanta Federal Reserve explained the importance of the debt money system and how it can strangle our economy. Someone has to borrow every dollar we have in circulation. If the banks create ample money, we are prosperous. If not, we starve. When one gets a complete grasp of the picture, the tragic absurdity of our hopeless position is incredible. It is the most important subject intelligent persons can investigate and reflect upon. It's true.
Well, there you
have
it.
The government does not create our money. The truth of money is that Congress has given the money power over.
So, Stephen, I hope that answered your question. It fleshed it out a little bit more, and everybody gave you just another quick appraisal of fractional reserve lending. It's very important for you to understand this. I mean, after all, it is your money, and that's how it comes into being. And so very few people do, and it's not taught in schools. They keep it under wraps for a very good reason. So there you go. Kevin Moran wrote in saying, Richard, heard on CBS this morning that 1 in 6 who owe student loan debt are unemployed. Well, there you are. That's an interesting statistic, and thank you for it, Kevin. 1 in 6 unemployed. Well, Fred Moore wrote in and said as follows, Hello, Richard. I've been listening to your show now for close to 8 months, and hard as it is to hear what you have to say, it is at least good to hear someone speak with such honesty about the world's perilous situation. I often wonder what it would be like if the mainstream media ran such intelligent and informative programs such as yours. Oh, well, thank you so much, Fred. I somehow feel that the gentle, docile lambs who are our citizenry would either go straight into a panic or yawn and turn the channel to Real Housewives. I've tried to speak with people about what I learned from your show, and no matter how logical it is, all presented almost verbatim from what you have said, they still find a way to dismiss it as either pumped-up conspiracy theory or irrational fear-mongering. We truly do live in an Orwellian society. Anyway, I would love to be added to your email list, and perhaps you could provide me with any info you have on teaching English abroad. Well, Fred, I'm sure you've got the information you need about teaching English abroad. There's been enough of that going around today. And I don't know, did you say where you are, where you live? Oh, yes, you're in New Jersey. No excuses for not going to the meetup group on Sunday, Fred. I shall be watching from 13,000 miles away. If I do not see your friendly visage there, there will be trouble, hell to pay. Anyway, let me finish off your email here. At this time, I'm employed as an inner-city firefighter, and my wife is a school teacher in New Jersey. I have resided in the fact that things will get so much worse that either one or both our jobs are on the line. I would like to square away a backup plan, and your help would be wonderful. Thank you for everything, and keep up the good work, Richard. Fred Moore. Well, Fred, seriously, this meetup group on Sunday looks like it's tailor-made for you. And I'm sure you'll go, and let me know how you enjoyed it and what interesting feedback you might have got. One more email from Renee Parsons, who says, "Hi, Richard. Would love to hear to address the slump in gold prices and whether you think that it's still a good long-term investment. Also, please add me to your email newsletter circulation. Many thanks, Renee Parsons." Renee, I think, first of all, you have been added, and so have you, Fred. The email, or rather the gold prices, I don't still think it's a good long-term investment. I didn't think that to start with, actually, Renee. I guess you haven't been listening to the show that long. We are in a depression. We are in a deflationary depression at the point where everything will go down in price. Now, if the drought continues in the Midwest, obviously grain prices might rise. There might always be exceptions for very specific reasons. But in the main, you will find prices fall, and I think you will find that that includes gold, silver, copper, platinum, palladium, whatever it may be. I think you'll find that they all fall. So I hope that that answers your question. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I believe we have come to the end of another show, and it remains for me to wish you a wonderful weekend, and I'll be back bright and early, 10 a.m. sharp, Monday morning, with more of the same. Take care. Speak to you then. Bye-bye.